Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Just imagine if you could quiet the noise and journey to deep sleep. Relax, I got you. I'm Shamir Anderson. Escape with me to soothing soundscapes around the globe. We'll wait out a storm on the Ethiopian highlands and take in the waves on a secluded Brazilian beach. Sleep sound with me, Shamir Anderson, an Audible original. Available now on audible.ca.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 2nd of May, these are our main stories. Police clashed with protesters taking part in May Day rallies in France against the rise in pension age. The UN warns Sudan is facing a humanitarian catastrophe as fighting continues. A Google engineer, widely considered to be the godfather of artificial intelligence, has quit his job with a warning about the growing dangers of AI. Also in this podcast, women whose husbands were taken from Russian prisons to fight the war in Ukraine say they're left with no information about their loved ones. We find out about the man honoured at one of fashion's biggest events of the year and...
I wouldn't classify all writers as being poor or broke, but I can say myself I have $6 in my bank account.
We're in Los Angeles, where last-minute talks are being held to avert a strike by Hollywood film and TV writers. We start in France. Where hundreds of thousands of people have attended May Day protests and vented their anger against President Emmanuel Macron's decision to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. As we were hearing there, violent clashes erupted in some cities. The authorities say more than 100 police were injured and nearly 300 people were detained. The French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, said the violence was unacceptable. Nathalie Goulet, a member of the French Senate for an opposition party, the UDI, says there's a lot of mistrust between the people and the government.
There is a lack of a dialogue between the president, the government and the people. And it's created a lot of violence and unhappiness with the people. And everything is boiling and boiling and boiling. And we are under the impression that that will never stop.
The unions had been hoping for a big turnout and May Day rallies took place across the country. Here are some views of some peaceful protesters in Paris.
I'm more determined than ever. If Macron has 4 more years, we'll go on 4 more years. No problem, I'm here, and there will be more of us. We'll win in the end, I'm convinced.
When people say the movement is running out of steam, it's not. It's the opposite. It's got so big for several years now that it can only grow. Even if there's not a lot of action, in spirit it's getting stronger.
Our correspondent Nick Beek spoke to us from Place de la Nation in eastern Paris.
Just looking around, I can see a lot of glass. That is from where some bus shelters have been smashed up by a hardcore of the protesters. We heard from the French police that about 112,000 people were involved in the march that set off earlier. But as is always the case, really, in Paris over the last few months or so, it's been a small number of protesters who have clashed with the police. And once again, that's happened. Tear gas hangs in the air here. And I'm just looking at about 6 or 7 different fire engines, because there was a building set ablaze, probably 5 or 6 stories high, and we watched as one man was brought to safety down a very long extended ladder. So once again, there have been clashes today after what started as a fairly peaceful protest.
And did you see some of the violence for yourself?
Yes, I did, and it was the people that call themselves, or they're known as the Black Bloc here. People who dress themselves in black, many cover their faces so they can't be identified, but also it's a way of dealing with the tear gas, which the police fired pretty quickly today. We'd heard from the head of the police here in Paris that they would be willing to use force where necessary so that, in the words of the top officer, people could protest peacefully without violence. And so that has been the justification for the police moving in pretty quickly when there has been some signs of trouble happening. And this has been actually replicated in a few other French cities today. Nantes, Lyon, for example, also Strasbourg as well, there was some trouble.
Of course, Nick, May the 1st is Labour Day in France. And as you were saying, rallies took place across France, not just in Paris. I know you've been speaking to protesters where you are. What are they saying to you? What are their grievances?
Yeah, that's a really interesting and I think important point. May Day is a traditional day of protest in France going back decades. But this year, the anger is fueled by what's going to be happening in the future, specifically the pension reform that President Macron has got through, for want of a better phrase, because he bypassed French Parliament here. That just exacerbated the anger of many, many people who saw it as an undemocratic thing to do, even though he was able to do it with all the powers that he has. And so it's this anger over pensions, which really lots of people are not happy with. The big question is, will the violence we've seen today, will this protest actually translate to a U-turn or any sort of concession from the government? It doesn't look like it at the moment.
Nick Beek in Paris. Fighting has continued in the Sudanese capital Khartoum as the United Nations warns of a worsening humanitarian disaster. Clashes again took place between rival military factions, despite promises to extend a ceasefare. The UN's humanitarian coordinator in Sudan said the conflict was turning into a full-blown catastrophe. And the UN Assistant High Commissioner for Refugees, Rauf Mazou, said a huge number might flee.
In consultation with all concerned governments and partners, we've arrived at a planning figure of 815,000 people that may flee into the seven neighboring countries. Without a quick resolution of this crisis, we will continue to see more people forced to flee in search of safety and basic assistance.
Foreign nationals who haven't been able to leave Sudan by plane are being taken by boat across the Red Sea to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding is there and sent us this report.
On the dockside here in Jeddah, consular officials from around the world wait to greet the latest arrivals from Sudan. Several hundred people, some in wheelchairs, are coming down the gangplank of a huge grey American Navy transport ship, the Brunswick. They've just sailed across the Red Sea overnight from Port Sudan. Before that, most had come by bus or car from Sudan's war-torn capital, Khartoum.
There's a lot of bombing and shooting.
And how are you feeling today now?
I'm feeling okay now that we're here and safe.
Did you get the feeling that Port Sudan is filling up with more and more people?
Yeah, there's people like sleeping on the floor and building tents.
Can we make a clear path here, please?
On this ship, more than 100 US citizens, most carrying no more than one piece of hand luggage, many fearful about what lies ahead for Sudan.
In a few days, it's going to be really bad because there is nothing to eat. There is no water, there is no electricity.
Two dozen British nationals come ashore too, including Mohamed Kadouk, an engineer from Scotland, and his son Omar.
It was scary. Terrifying.
There's a few shells that hit the house.
Your own house?
Yes, on the roof of the house. A few neighbours, a girl, she was 16 years old, broke bullet in the house, killed her.
Killed her?
Yeah.
This sea crossing to Saudi Arabia has emerged as an increasingly important part of a global effort to evacuate foreigners from Sudan. But there are still millions of Sudanese in even more urgent need of help.
Andrew Harding. It's just days away from the coronation of Charles III. The king will be crowned the British monarch on Saturday and will also be formally recognised as the head of state in 14 other Commonwealth realms, including Australia. The Labour government there has promised a referendum on the monarchy in the next few years, but constitutional change is rare. Only 8 out of 44 referendums have been passed in Australia since 1901. Phil Mercer has been speaking to Australians on both sides of the debate.
Prince Charles, the 17-year-old heir to the throne, arrives in Sydney on his way to attend school at Timberton.
King Charles first visited Australia in 1966 and has a special connection to the country.
There's a big crowd to see him here too, but the young prince takes it all in his stride.
But the death of the Queen has once again reignited debate about constitutional reform. Matt Thistlethwaite is Australia's Assistant Minister for the Republic. He believes that change is well overdue.
We woke up in September last year when the Queen passed away, and all of a sudden we had a new head of state. The Australian people weren't consulted about that. The Australian people didn't get a choice in who should be their head of state, despite the fact that we govern by democratic means.
The Queen's reign is over. Charles is king, and now there's a renewed push to make Australia a republic. We've been asked once before, and it was on this date in 1999. The country said no.
Australia voted against severing its ties to the British Crown in 1999. But Adam Spencer from the Australian Republic movement senses a new opportunity.
He is King Charles of Australia. In 2023, does it feel right for our head of state to be a foreign-born king? We say no. It should be one of us who serves in that position for all of us.
Here is high history in the making. As the Gothic steams into the majesty of Sydney Harbour, a royal setting for a royal arrival. Hardly another city in all the world could open so splendid a gateway for a sovereign and her husband. For the Queen is coming. Our Queen.
Queen Elizabeth was widely admired and respected here. Supporters of the monarchy believe the system has made Australia's democracy safe and secure. Here are the views of two activists, Alessandro Rossini and Rachel Bales.
They do not come here as peripheral gossip figures. They come here as people that have a role in our constitution. I believe that a constitutional monarchy is a system that works. It allows our government to get on with the business of serving the people of Australia through hard-nosed issues like the economy, energy crisis, housing affordability.
I am a constitutional monarchist and I'm a proud constitutional monarchist. And I say that both as a young Australian and also as someone of a strong multicultural background given my Greek and Italian descent. I can vividly remember my grandparents who left Greece coming to Australia speaking about why they picked our country, because it's stable, because it's prosperous and because it is a better system of government.
Let's talk about Australia's next head of state.
In our current system, that person will be the head of the royal family in England.
Ultimately, it will be up to about 18 million Australian voters to decide the country's constitutional future.
I would rather that we were a republic. I voted for that back in the 90s.
I grew up in England, so I'm an Australian citizen now, but I think it's fantastic. I think the royal family do a great job.
I think that the monarch has become a bit less relevant to Australia than it was previously.
I'm in favour of the monarchy. I'm not a republican, you know. All the best for King Charles.
We're an ancient country, but we've grown up a lot. I think it could be time for us to have an Australian as head of state.
Not one of us.
Not voted for by us.
Not accountable to us in any way.
Shouldn't our head of state be an Aussie?
Although enthusiastic for change, Australia's Labor government says a vote on a republic won't be held until its next term in office if it's re-elected. Another referendum is taking priority. Later this year, Australians will decide whether to recognise Indigenous people in the Constitution.
Phil Mercer. For the first time in 15 years, Hollywood film and TV writers are threatening to go on strike if they can't reach a deal to get better pay and working conditions. Saturday Night Live and The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon are just some of the shows that would be affected immediately. As we record this podcast, talks are continuing between the Writers Guild of America and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which represents Disney, Netflix and hundreds of other production companies. They've got until midnight local time to reach an agreement. Our correspondent in Los Angeles, Sophie Long, told us about the writers' main concerns.
Fundamentally, this is about pay. Just as streaming changed the way we watch television, it also changed the way TV is made and how people get paid to make it. Now, the streamers typically commission series with fewer episodes, which require fewer people to write them, and those that do are earning less money. A writer on a hit broadcast show also used to expect residuals, payments made when a show is rerun. But residuals in streaming are also smaller and don't fully account for the success of a show. So all this means that writers are having to work more for less, and they're they're not very happy about it. According to the WGA, pay for writer producers has dropped by 4% over the past decade. And if you take into account inflation, that's more like 23%. So a big hit, they're saying. 28-year-old Alex O'Keefe is currently looking for jobs at cinemas in case there is a strike.
I wouldn't classify all writers as being poor or broke, but I can say myself, I have $6 in my bank account. When I won the award for The Bear on FX, the show I wrote for, I won an award for it. When I went to the award show, the suit was bought by my friends and family. The bow tie was bought on credit. I didn't have any money. I had a negative bank account.
So how likely is it, Sophie, do you think that the writers will get what they want? Because after all, Hollywood studios can't really do without them. I mean, they are so much of the talent, aren't they?
The two sides have until midnight tonight, LA time, to reach a deal. Some, I have to say, are still hopeful that will happen, but most people we're talking to at this stage in the game think that a strike in some form is inevitable. I've spoken to writers who are busy making picket signs, and it's fair to say that both sides at this stage are preparing for the worst. Now, as much as writers feel they're losing out, and pretty much everyone agrees they are, media companies say streaming isn't working for them either. Every major media company has cut costs over the last year, and most of them have fired staff as well. So while the strike isn't in either side's interest, and this is an industry, of course, still recovering from the pandemic, which halted production and has since made it much more costly to make. Post-COVID-19 protocols have added as much as 20% to budgets. There are a few reasons that the studios might want to hold out. Firstly, for many streaming shows, the season is coming to a natural end. So in terms of new seasons of shows yet to be written, they may feel they have a little time to play with. Secondly, they can, of course, buy an international series that aren't being affected by this potential strike. And thirdly, it's important to remember that the Writers Guild is the first union to renegotiate its contract with the studios. They'll be looking ahead to the next set of negotiations. Both contracts with the directors and the actors' unions are up at the end of June. And the results of the first union's negotiations tend to be passed along to others when they reach the negotiating table. So the studios won't want to cede too much ground right now. So we should learn tonight whether there's been a compromise, but it could be as early as midnight tonight that writers down their tools.
Sophie Long. Still to come in this podcast, should a family that's already given reparations for its historic benefits from slavery in the Caribbean pay for its ancestors' role in Ireland's Great Famine?
Sir Charles was acting for the British state, and the British state has acknowledged his role and said that it was wrong. Whereas in the Caribbean, we're talking about a family that privately profited from a crime against humanity.
He's been described as the godfather of artificial intelligence. But now Geoffrey Hinton is warning of the dangers of AI and products like ChatGPT if they fall into the wrong hands. Mr. Hinton worked as a Google engineer and helped develop the foundations for technology like ChatGPT. Last week, he quit his job and says he now feels regrets about his life's work. The BBC's Sumi Somaskanda asked him how much he trusts the world's biggest tech companies to move forward with AI responsibly.
Well, I think one problem is that Microsoft decided to put one of these advanced chatbots into Bing and in other products. And Google doesn't have much choice but to respond to that. It can't just sit back and not compete with Microsoft. Before that, Google was in the lead in AI, and Google chose not to release these things because of all the dangers. It used them internally, and it used them to make search better and so on, but it didn't actually release them to the public, even though it had chatbots, because of the potential dangers. And so in that sense, I think Google behaved very responsibly, but you can only do that when you're in the lead. And if you're competing with a company that's using these things, you have to use them too.
Jeff, Microsoft didn't come to this technology, of course, on its own. You've been part of the incredible research that has gone into AI over several years now. So who is responsible for AI reaching where it is now?
Well, we're scientists, right? We're exploring what happens when you train large neural nets on computers. And that's just reality that we ended up here. It's one of those things where there's no way that people weren't going to explore it. The issue is, now that we've discovered it works better than we expected a few years ago, what do we do to mitigate the long-term risks of things more intelligent than us taking control?
Let's talk about those risks, because you've said that you're worried about bad actors. What worries you the most about what could be used with this technology?
So there's a lot of things that a lot of other people have talked about to do with being able to produce lots of text automatically, so you can get lots of very effective spam bots. It'll allow authoritarian leaders to manipulate their electorates, things like that. I'm not really talking about those. There's another particular thing I want to talk about, which is the existential risk of what happens when these things get more intelligent than us. So quite recently, I've come to the conclusion that the kind of intelligence we're developing is very different from the intelligence we have. Mm. We're biological systems, and these are digital systems. And the big difference is that with digital systems, you have many copies of the same set of weights, the same model of the world. And all these copies can learn separately, but share their knowledge instantly. So it's as if you had 10,000 people, and whenever one person learned something, everybody automatically knew it. And that's how these chatbots can know so much more than any one person.
You've said, Jeff, yourself, that we don't know exactly yet how the human brain works. So how do we know that what you've just described does indeed eclipse human intelligence?
We don't know. And right now, what we're seeing is things like GPT-4 eclipses a person in the amount of general knowledge it has, and eclipses them by a long way. In terms of reasoning, it's not as good, but it does already do simple reasoning. And given the rate of progress, we expect things to get better quite fast. So we need to worry about that. Right now, they're not more intelligent than us, as far as I can tell. But I think they soon may be.
Jeffrey Hinton. The Wagner mercenary group has played a prominent role in Russia's war in Ukraine. They've been allowed by the authorities to recruit tens of thousands of inmates from Russian prisons, promising that after 6 months of service, if they survive, they'll be pardoned and returned to civilian life. But they're often sent into the harshest battles, such as in Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine, where many have already been killed. As Martin Venart has been finding out, even their closest relatives have difficulty finding out exactly what happened to them.
I tried to persuade him in every way I could not to do it, but he said he was being kept in prison in unbearable conditions and that it would be better to be blown up by a mine than to stay there.
That's Maria, not her real name. I spoke to her recently. We've completely voiced over what she said in Russian so as not to reveal her identity. She said that her husband had been serving a long sentence in provincial Russia for drugs offences when, at the end of last year, representatives of Wagner went to his prison. They offered inmates their freedom and a pardon after serving for 6 months with the mercenary group in Ukraine.
Война тяжелая, на всякие там чеченские и так далее.
That is widely believed to be the founder of Wagner, Yevgeny Prigozhin, filmed making the same offer a few months earlier at another prison. He said that those who were killed in battle would be buried not as convicts, but as heroes. The last time Maria spoke to her husband was by phone in January, shortly before he was taken to Ukraine. After several weeks without any news about him, Maria started asking questions.
I tried to find out from the prison authorities what had happened to him. They said he'd signed a contract with Wagner, and that was the last they knew about him. I eventually managed to get through to Wagner, and they gave me the number of someone who compiles a list of people who've died in Ukraine. I call him every 2 weeks. He said my husband's name is not on the list.
But Maria was not sure if this man actually worked for Wagner, and she was not reassured.
In a lot of interviews I've heard and videos that I've seen online, I can see that Wagner very often leaves dead bodies on the battlefield and nobody knows about them.
Unofficial internet chat groups have been set up for Russians trying to find out information about their loved ones who were serving in the war. Maria posted a photo of her husband on one of them.
I am telling you that I saw him. I cannot be mistaken, as I have a very good memory for faces.
Someone contacted me who who said he was also serving with Wagner and said he had seen my husband 6 days after he was released from prison. Then they were involved in some fighting, and he said he thought that my husband was dead.
So here we are in the BBC's Russian service, and you are?
My name is Olga Ivshina. I'm a senior reporter for BBC Russian.
How common is it for people in Russia not to be able to find out about their relatives who are fighting in Ukraine?
Amongst Wagner recruits, that's very common, especially if they joined Wagner straight from prison. We get quite a lot of messages from people like that, and we also see more messages like that to appear in different social media channels where these desperate people, usually women, their mothers or their wives, try to get any news about their relatives, usually inmates.
Maria wanted me to contact Wagner on her behalf. I discussed with specialist staff at the BBC how this might be done without identifying Maria as the source of the inquiry, as she had said things that could be seen as being critical of Wagner, something which is against the law in Russia. We made a plan, but before it could be enacted, Maria sent a message saying Wagner had contacted her to say that her husband had been killed in Ukraine several days earlier, although not how or where he had died. She was sceptical that he had died so recently, given that his remains had already been returned in a sealed coffin, which they'd told her not to open. They said that she would have to organise and pay for the funeral, but that she would be reimbursed later, up to the equivalent of around $1,200, which just covered the expenses. We have voiced up one of her messages.
I've been left with nothing. I had to borrow the money to bury him. I even had to pay for a plot in the cemetery.
It was far from the hero's burial that the Wagner founder Yevgeny Prigozhin had promised, and Maria, like the relatives of many other Russian recruits, has been left with a lot of unanswered questions.
Martin Bernard. Whether countries, companies and even individual families should pay reparations for crimes of the past is fiercely debated. The former BBC journalist Laura Trevelyan made headlines last year when she travelled to the Caribbean island of Grenada to apologise for her family's links to slavery. The family also promised to pay more than $120,000 in compensation. But this led to further questions about the role of one of her ancestors in the Irish famine and whether the Trevelyans should offer money to Ireland itself. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
The Great Famine is one of the defining moments of Irish history. Between 1845 and 1852, more than 1 million people died. Another million fled the country out of desperation. Emigration and death caused the population to fall by up to 25%. It began with a natural disaster, the failure of the potato crop. But the actions of the UK government, which controlled the whole island at that point, made the situation much, much worse. Not enough aid was sent, and crops were being exported from Ireland while its people starved. Sir Charles Trevelyan was the official in charge of famine relief in the 1840s. He limited the food aid programme and wrote that the judgment of God sent the calamity to teach the Irish a lesson. He was so hated that a folk song even singled him out for blame.
For you stole Trevelyan's car, so the young might see.
Speaking to BBC Radio Ulster, his descendant Laura Trevelyan said her family would consider offering compensation if the Irish government asked. But she said it was a different situation to what her ancestors had done in the Caribbean.
Sir Charles was acting as for the British state, and the British state has acknowledged his role and said that it was wrong. Whereas in the Caribbean, we're talking about a family that privately profited from a crime against humanity.
Laura Trevelyan says her family have confronted their slave-owning past. She's encouraging others, including the British monarchy and government, to do the same.
Charlotte Gallagher. The first Monday in May marks fashion's biggest night of the year, the Met Gala in New York. Each year has a unique theme, and this year's event honours the late German designer Karl Lagerfeld, known as a creative and marketing genius for his work with fashion houses from Chanel to Fendi. Our correspondent Neda Tofik watched the celebrities walk up the red carpet, and she spoke to us on a slightly glitchy lag.
We've had Nicole Kidman, Penelope Cruz coming, saying that they chose looks that Karl Lagerfeld had designed for them. So Nicole Kidman wearing a pink gown with feathers that Karl Lagerfeld had designed personally for her. And then Penelope Cruz wore a light blue gown with a veil on it. Hood, I should say, rather than a veil. She said that she had her pick of different Chanel looks from the hive and that she wanted to go with something more vintage than modern. But I can tell you all across the carpet, we've been seeing a lot of black and white, a lot of men like James McAvoy, the actor channeling the Karl Lagerfeld style of the black blazer, crisp white tops. James McAvoy actually telling me that this is his favorite red carpet because given it's out of his industry, he's able to come here, have a good time. I asked him what happens inside the Met Gala. He said it was something he couldn't reveal. So a fun night here for many who are coming. This is fashion's biggest night. I should say, though, that there has been a bit of criticism about Karl Lagerfeld's past comments when it comes to women's bodies, saying he was over the Me Too movement. I actually had a chance to ask Anna Wintour about that. She said what they were celebrating here was not the man, but his body of work.
And it's not just actors and models, is it? I also spotted Roger Federer.
That's right. Anna Wintour makes this guest list of about 400 people based on what she says a reflection of the culture. So those who are making buzz, those who had great accomplishments. So the biggest names really in sports, fashion, but also politics. We're expecting Brittany Griner to come on the carpet. She is one of the guests tonight. She, of course, being detained in Russia for 10 months, has just been out speaking about that experience.
Neda Tofik at the Met Gala in New York. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Iona Hampson. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Fifteen years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martina Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Just imagine if you could quiet the noise and journey to deep sleep. Relax, I got you. I'm Shamir Anderson. Escape with me to soothing soundscapes around the globe. We'll wait out a storm on the Ethiopian highlands and take in the waves on a secluded Brazilian beach. Sleep sound with me, Shamir Anderson, an Audible original. Available now on audible.ca.
When your business travel is out of balance, you feel it. At National Car Rental, you're in control. Skip the counter, choose any car in the aisle, and manage your rental right from the app. So you can balance the boardroom with the not-so-board. Climb rocks after you rock your presentation. And mix work with leisure. Or leisure with work. Find the perfect balance with National Car Rental. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.